Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Between anti-vaxxers, flat earthers, QAnon followers, and the deluge of misinformation online, trying to have a conversation based on a shared set of facts can be frustrating and rather frightening. The internet has enabled conspiracy theories to metastasize. You'd think having access to nearly every piece of information humanity has ever generated would make it that much easier to debunk these strange and sometimes dangerous ideas. But maybe the problem is the medium. What if it's the structure of the internet itself, the hidden structure, the algorithms behind the scenes pulling the strings that make it easier to believe there are secret forces at work offline, pulling the strings in the real world? Joining me now is journalist, science fiction author, digital rights activist Cory Doctorow, who makes the case in a recently published web book, How to Destroy Surveillance Capitalism on 1-0, Medium Text and Science Publication. Cory, welcome to All of It.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
So the notion that the tech sphere and the market for big data and the incentive to watch us are somehow rogue elements, an outlier in some way in the broader text of capitalism, but you don't think so. Why not?
Yeah, I really, I think that like there's two prevailing explanations for all the weird stuff that's happening on the internet. One is that like big tech created a mind control ray to sell your kids fidget spinners, and then Robert Mercer stole it and made your uncle a racist. And the other is that big tech has got a bunch of monopolies, and that they're part of a wider trend to monopolies, and that monopolies are super corrosive to our social consensus, and they make us not believe in our institutions because they're really corrupting. And so when someone says, hey, how can you, why would you believe the official story? We know that they lie and that the watchdogs are working for the people they're supposed to be guarding us against. They sound plausible.
Can you point to a particular development in the history of big tech when it changed from something that was still figuring out itself to something that it needed to be tamed?
Sure. I think that it comes from a shift not to advertising, but rather to growth through mergers and acquisitions. That for the longest time, the way that new companies would enter the market is by trying to eat the lunch of the company that already existed. So like, you know, Google comes along and they try to challenge AltaVista and Yahoo by making a better search engine. Or Facebook comes along and they make a little tool that logs into MySpace for you and gets your waiting MySpace messages and puts them in your Facebook inbox so that they could overcome the dominance MySpace had just by kind of muscling aside MySpace's walled garden and letting new Facebook users stay in touch with their old MySpace friends. And at a certain point, instead of growing that way, what they start doing is just these predatory acquisitions. And so you have companies like Google that have grown but have only ever made 1.5 products. They made a great search engine, a pretty good Hotmail clone, and everything else is just an acquisition they bought from someone else. And as they grow this way, as they become more of a financial story and less of an innovation story, their innovation is focused not on better products, which they have to make to please customers, but on regulatory advantage, figuring out how not to pay taxes, figuring out how to subvert privacy laws, figuring out how to subvert antitrust laws that would bar them from buying rivals.
So the idea is someone else is making all the interesting things. We're just making the money to buy the interesting things.
Yeah, or to neutralize them, right? Because if you look at so many of these companies, I mean, Yahoo's really the poster child for this. You have the, the Saudi royal family says, we need to get out of oil. So they give a bunch of money to SoftBank and they say, go make some giant investments. And you know, the latter day version of that is the SoftBank investments we all know, like Uber and WeWork, that are just, you know, gross grifts. But they started with Yahoo and they bankrolled Yahoo to buy, you know, every single promising startup that emerged from Silicon Valley and then mismanage it into the grave, right? One after another, Flickr and Upcoming and Tumblr, you know, these are companies that had, millions, billions of users, well, not billions, but hundreds of millions of users were sold for billions of dollars. People loved them. They did things that no one had ever done. Flickr had the first, you know, mobile photo sharing years before Instagram, before even smartphones. And they just failed to do anything with them. But what they did do was keep them from growing into competitors for the in-house services.
My guest is Cory Doctorow. His latest web book is called How to Destroy Surveillance Capitalism. Cory, you've written a lot about the impact of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Now, for those who don't know, what is the DCMA?
Yeah, it's a gnarly hairball of legislation signed into law by Bill Clinton in 1998. And the section that really this book deals with is Section 1201. And this is a law that makes it a felony to help someone remove a copyright lock, a digital rights management lock. So, you know, the first ones of these were like on your DVD player to stop you from buying a DVD in India and playing it in America. Mm. Although that's not illegal, right? If you go pay the list price for a DVD in India, watching it on a DVD player is what copyright is supposed to accomplish. Buy the work at the list price, enjoy it in private in your home. And the way that the DMCA is structured, Section 1201, says that it's a felony even if no copyright infringement takes place. And over the years, companies have realized that if you design a product so that you have to remove a copyright lock to do something that upsets their shareholders, that because removing copyright locks is a felony, then upsetting the shareholders becomes a felony. So you see this like with Medtronic, a company that makes mm-hmm. the leading ventilator model. And they've designed their ventilators so that fixing the screen requires unlocking a copyright lock. So you have these refurbishers who have broken ventilators who are taking screens from other ventilators and swapping them in, and they can't get them to work without committing a felony, even though there's no copyright violation. So this idea of felony contempt of business model, it becomes a means by which companies can prevent competitors from plugging into their services. You know, Facebook was able to grow by plugging into MySpace, even though MySpace didn't want them to. They could do this competitive compatibility thing. But, you know, if you try to do that to Facebook, as a company called Power Ventures does, that they're able to use various legal doctrines, the DMCA, another antiquated Reagan-era law called the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act that Reagan signed into law in a panic after watching Matthew Broderick in War Games, which has been mm-hmm. expanded to make it a crime to violate terms of service. You have this thicket of laws that allows companies to decide who can compete with them and how. And I think that's a much better explanation for how they got big, that they just prevented competition, than the idea that they have somehow perfected mind control through machine learning, you know, which is a claim whose only major source is their own marketing brochures, where they go like, advertise on Google and we'll convince people to buy whatever it is you're selling. It's not a reliable source of information. You know, the much more parsimonious explanation, the more likely one, is that they're just banal monopolists like Carnegie or like Bill Gates or like Mellon, and that they're doing exactly the same sociopathic cheating stuff that every monopolist has done since the first monopolists.
So why are we still operating with laws from the Clinton and Reagan administrations about something that has changed so much?
Well, really, I think there's another Reagan change that we can blame on this, and this is okay. the elimination of antitrust enforcement. Right? Mm-hmm. We changed from enforcing antitrust law broadly to say that monopolies themselves are evil to this weird theory that Reagan's pet legal theorist, a guy who'd served in the Nixon administration and was denied a seat on the Supreme Court because of his complicity in Nixon's crimes, named Robert Bork. He came up with this idea that the only time we should punish a monopoly is if we can show that right after they did something monopolistic, prices went up. And so as a result, we've let companies grow in ways that they never were allowed to grow before, through these anti-competitive mergers and creations of vertical monopolies. And that is so profitable that they divert the profits to keeping us from passing good laws, you know, witness the tooth and nail fight against a federal privacy act, and to create bad interpretations of existing laws. So look at Oracle spending tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars to create a new copyright law out of thin air in a lawsuit against Google that would make it illegal to make a new compatible product using something called an API that companies, including Oracle, have cloned from their rivals since time immemorial.
Are you heartened to hear it? Last night it broke that the Federal Trade Commission is considering filing an antitrust lawsuit against Facebook by the end of the year. How did you receive that news?
Yeah, I think that this is part of a wider trend because of, you know, the other thing that I reject about the prevailing surveillance capitalism idea is that there's something exceptional about tech. They are ordinary mediocrities just like you and me. And they have a monopoly that from, you know, 10 miles up in the air is indistinguishable from the monopolies we see in every industry, from eyewear to pro wrestling to beer to finance to transportation. And now, as we've seen during the pandemic, to emergency rooms and hospitals. And I think that, like, in the same way that before the environmental movement came about, there were people who cared about owls and people who cared about the ozone layer, but they didn't think that they were fighting the same fight. And the term ecology turned 1,000 issues into one movement with 1,000 ways to get involved. And in the same way, there are people who are angry because a monopoly cost them their job, or because a monopoly in meatpacking killed their family member who was working in the plant, or a monopoly in the poultry industry drove their chicken farmer family member to suicide, as is happening across the country, or who are angry because the pro wrestlers they love used to have their choice of 30 leagues to fight in, and now there's just one owned by this billionaire Trumpist named Vince McMahon, who reclassified them all as contractors, took away their health insurance, and now they're begging for money on GoFundMe to die with dignity in their 50s of their work-related injuries. And all these people don't know it, but they're fighting the same fight. And I think that we're going to see people who are angry because they can't get broadband and their kids can't get an education making common cause with the screenwriters who are pissed off because the three major Hollywood studios decided that they would start taking money out of their client, or the three major Hollywood talent agencies would take money out of their clients' pockets and do sweetheart deals with the studios. We're all fighting the same fight.
My guest is Cory Doctorow. The name of his new web book is How to Destroy Surveillance Capitalism. At the root of a lot of problems of big tech is the question of advertising. So can you draw a line from the way big tech makes money to some of the sort of more harmful aspects of our online lives?
So I think that the one truism about advertising is that advertising is best at selling advertising, right? That the people they convince the most are their clients. Actually, it's not true. The people they convince the most are themselves. They all think they're doing a great job. And so do their clients. You know, Wanamaker, the department store magnate, infamously quipped, 50% of my advertising spending is wasted. I just don't know which 50%. Imagine doing such a great sell job on Wanamaker that he thought that only 50% of his advertising money was wasted, you know? As we saw, as soon as we got metrics with the internet, more than 99% of your advertising money goes nowhere. And big tech has this story that if you spy on people a lot, you can really make advertising more effective. And the literature doesn't bear that out. When you look at contextual advertising, that is when you like use a couple of pieces of information, like what is this article about? And what country is this reader coming from or city, that you can serve ads that make about the same amount of money without incurring the billions of dollars in expense to spy on people, not to mention all the, you know, bad social consequences of spying on people, and get about the same dollar figure. But they want to spin the story that they've built a mind control ray. Now, of course, spying on people all the time is really harmful to them. It's harmful because it stops you being your authentic self because you're worried you're being spied on. It's harmful because it's a source of endless compromat. You know, think about the Ashley Madison breach, where it was a dating site for people who wanted to cheat on their spouses. And, you know, within about a month of each other, we had the Ashley Madison breach and the Office of Personnel Management breach, which was when the U.S. government agency that hands out classified clearance to American government employees and private sector employees both breached. And imagine what you could do by cross-referencing people who have classified clearance and people who are cheating on their spouses. You know, this is potentially enormously harmful. And this is the great tragedy, not that they figured out how to manipulate us to this fine degree and robbed of us of our free will, but rather that they have corrupted our society and gathered all of this data as part of a convincer in a grift where they you know, that all they're doing is trying to ward off competitors, because if you try to enter the market, they say, well, how could you ever defeat us? Think about how much data we have. We've been spying on people for 20 years. Like, what does 20 years worth of data help you sell, right? Maybe a roof. If you know 20 years ago I bought a roof, maybe you can sell me another roof. It's not like anything more than a couple of weeks old is going to help you sell me much. So, you know, the idea that they have these impenetrable walls is very useful to them. You know, the big tech ad companies, they have billions of dollars in revenue, double-digit year-on-year growth. They grew through the pandemic. And investors won't invest in their competitors, which is pretty weird, right? Like, if you had a business that had such an amazing margin that it had double-digit year-on-year growth, you would think that investors' response to that would be like, give me some of that, right? But instead, they're like, huh, we can't ever hope to compete with those guys out of a combination of this superstitious belief in the all-powerful ability to mine data and, of course, the willingness of these companies to cheat and use anti-competitive tactics to crush their opponents.
My guest is journalist, science fiction author, and digital rights activist Cory Doctorow. His new web book is called How to Destroy Surveillance Capitalism. We'll have more with Cory after a quick break. We're back with journalist, science fiction author, digital rights activist Cory Doctorow. So, Cory, before the break, we were talking about your latest nonfiction piece, but a lot of people know you for your fictional work as well. Before we start talking about individual stories, I want to ask you, when you start feeling the urge to write and you have some issue you want to tackle, how do you decide what your best delivery system is, whether that's fiction, Twitter, a column? How do you decide?
You know, it's a quasi-mystical experience. I for 20 years, have been a blogger. I was one of the original bloggers at Boing Boing. I still co-own the site, though I don't write there anymore. And for 20 years, everything that seemed like it was significant to me, I turned into a post-Republic consumption. And it creates this kind of like super saturated solution of fragmentary story ideas that just kind of knock around. Because like explaining something to a stranger helps you remember it and understand it. And every now and again, a couple of those little bits will like glom together and nucleate and something crystallizes out of it. And sometimes it's a short story and sometimes it's an essay and sometimes it's a nonfiction book like this one. And sometimes it's a novel. And it really depends.
So in March 2019, you have published a book called Radicalized, a collection of four novellas. Let's talk about first Unauthorized Bread, which really investigates the dark side of the Internet of Things, where the interconnected of our device and our tech across platforms and devices. In this universe that you created in the novella, how does bread become unauthorized?
Yeah, well, this is back to this DMCA 1201 idea, right, where companies can manufacture things so that you have to use them in ways that benefit them and not ways that benefit you, even if they're, you know, notionally yours. And it's a story about refugees in subsidized housing that was built by this spiteful developer who couldn't get planning permission unless he agreed to have some subsidized units in his luxury building. And everything in the building is designed to pick their pocket, including the toaster, which will only accept authorized bread, and the washing machine that will only let them use laundry from the authorized clothing vendors and so on, which, you know, frankly, is not far off. Amazon just announced Alexa for landlords. So we're getting there. Mm. And what happens is that these companies, like all grifty companies, periodically go through a bracing bankruptcy to shed the debt that they accumulated from suckers stupid enough to loan them money. And when they do, all their servers shut down for a while and everything stops working. And so this prompts Salima, a young woman from Syria, to start jailbreaking her devices. And she teaches the kids in the building to do it. And this ushers in a kind of golden age for the people in the building. But then she realizes that the company is reemerging from bankruptcy, that they're going to figure out what she did, charge her with felonies under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, get her deported, and maybe murdered. And it becomes a life or death story.
Another story is called The Mask of the Red Death, which is about survivalists living in a self-imposed quarantine.
Yeah. So, yeah, that turned out to be timely, huh?
Huh. Would you have told the story differently now that we've all been through something like this?
You know, not really. I think we're really living through the underlying principle of that story, which is that the thing behind preppers is not a rational belief in the end of the world and what they need to do to prevent it, but rather like a desire to matter. If you look at what each prepper does, what they do is they say, what kind of end of the world event would I be important in? And then they prepare for that end of the world, even though, you know, that has no bearing on what disasters might emerge. And it's kind of this extended fantasy, and it's not entirely harmless. And, you know, when it comes to like finance bros and plutocrats, it's hard to imagine what end of the world you need to have, you would need to have like corporate raiders in, people who are really good at exotic financial instruments. And these guys, you know, they imagine it. They imagine that they can go down into their luxury bunker with their thumb drives full of Bitcoin and their gemstone quality rubies. And that when the better people than them have finished rebuilding civilization, they can emerge and like use their AR-15s and their loyal henchmen to become Frazetta warlords with a harem. And, you know, actually what it turns out is that in times of crisis, we need people who can figure out the sanitation. And since that's not them, they all die of cholera, you know?
In the novella Radicalized, you follow an online forum that takes the grief and anger of husbands whose wives are dying of cancer and then funnels it into violent acts against, wait for it, insurance companies.
Yeah.
From what you know about the way, we talked about this a little bit at the top, the way that conspiracy theories metastasized, how did you incorporate that into this story?
I think that that the plausibility of conspiracy theories is driven by trauma and the reality of corruption, right? That on the one hand, if you are being traumatized because your insurance company refuses to treat your most beloved person in the world's cancer because they claim that the treatment is experimental and you have to watch them die a slow, preventable, painful death, that makes you primed to believe in conspiracy theories. And then if someone comes along and says, well, the insurance companies, they don't care. In fact, they're getting rich. The executives at these insurance companies are getting rich off of it, and they should be made to suffer. Well, it's not a long line from that, especially given America's love affair with heavy-duty firearms, from that to people becoming suicide bombers and mass shooters who target the insurance industry. And it's told from the point of view of someone who doesn't fall down that rabbit hole, but sees it as his duty to try to rescue the men who are, and mm-hmm. and about what it takes to make change in a situation as deadlocked as ours.
And then there's the story of Model Minority, told from the point of view of this Superman-like figure struggling with how to wield his powers as a white ally against a militarized police force. When you wrote it, he had already saved the world from destruction several times. So why is this so hard for him, this issue of a militarized police force, if he's already saved the world?
Yeah, I wrote this while reading Matt Taibbi's book about the murder of Eric Garner by the NYPD called I Can't Breathe. And like a lot of people who encounter tales of horrific, corrupt violence, I kept thinking about this in individual terms, like why doesn't someone step forward, right? Why can't we just have a hero to save the day? And that's Superman's origin story. You know, Superman was written by a couple of Jewish kids, one from Toronto, where I'm from, Joe Schuster. My parents used to live on Joe Schuster Way. And they were watching the unfolding horror of Nazism across the ocean. And they imagined like a golem that would go and punch Nazis, right? Until Nazis stop being Nazis. And of course, that's not how we ever solve systemic problems. The solution to Nazis was not a superhero. It was the largest collective action problem that we ever solved as a species. It was this huge collaborative effort to stave off the growth of fascism and to beat it back. And you know, this is Superman's problem, and it was Superman's problem to begin with. So when this character, the American Eagle, discovers that, for example, his good buddy Bruce Wayne is the arms dealer who sold the NYPD the predictive policing tool that sent them to harass the black man that he stops them from beating to death in the opening scene, he kind of has to reckon with the fact that, you know, maybe as the old comedy sketch has it, maybe he's been the baddie all along.
So are you just incredibly prescient, or given how we just described these past four stories, or
yeah.
Are you just plugged into some place that we should all be plugging into? I've been very curious about where you get these ideas.
So I call it predicting the present. You know, like in 2006, I wrote a book that came out in 2008 called Little Brother. And Little Brother is a book about kids in San Francisco who, after a terrorist attack, discover that their city has been turned into a militarized police state, and that the real problem is not the terror attack, which happens and is over and is a tragedy that they grieve from, but which isn't an ongoing source of chaos and terror for them. It's the response to it. And they form a guerrilla army, and they use a network of hacked cryptographically secured Xboxes, and they outmaneuver the DHS and restore the Bill of Rights to California. And this is a book that's still read today. You know, they teach it at West Point. It's read in computer science programs. I got an honorary PhD in computer science partially off the back of that book. And you know, the reason it's still relevant today is it it supposes that on the one hand, computers will only become more important to us, and that on the other hand, for various reasons, we will refuse to grapple with them and will instead engage in wishful thinking, like saying, maybe we can have computers that are cryptographically secure, but that the police can break into, which is a thing that, you know, Bill Barr was mooting this year in a bipartisan effort with very powerful Democratic senators. So, you know, I've got a new one in that series that's about to come out in October called Attack Surface. And it's a book about a young woman who her whole life has been spent building surveillance tools, tools that were used to hunt insurgents in Iraq or put down democratic movements in the former Soviet Union. And she comes back to America and has this moral reckoning with her career because her best friend is now a Black Lives Matter activist in Oakland who's being targeted by the same cyber weapons that she built. And, you know, this is about to come out in a moment in which people are being targeted by these cyber weapons. There's this mass reckoning among tech workers and so on. And really the bet I made 3 years ago when I started working on this book is that the problem would get worse because we wouldn't grapple with it. I would love to be wrong, right? If the only prescience here is a cynicism that I'm mildly ashamed of, that the activist work I do will not be enough to get a shot of this, and that maybe it's going to take more books and more activists and more shoe leather to actually make the change that we so desperately need to treat computers as things that give us more autonomy, more self-determination, and more pluralism, and to turn away from the use of technology as a means to control, manipulate, and surveil people.
All right, last question. Since you talked about change in your last answer, if you could change one thing, what would it be in terms of tech policy that would have a big impact?
Oh my goodness. I think the one most realistic thing that we could do is a federal privacy act with a private right of action. So something modeled on California's CCPA, where, you know, you have the right not to have your data abused or stored without your consent, and it has to be explicit consent, and they can't punish you for failing to give the consent by saying, sorry, you then don't get to use our service anymore. And then it has to have a private right of action so that you don't have to get your attorney general or your district attorney to bring a case if your privacy is abused. You can hire a lawyer. And if you set it up so that you can recover fees and exemplary damages, statutory damages, then lawyers will beat your door down to sue the giant companies that abuse you. And that, I think, would make such a tremendous shift overnight in the way that companies relate to this stuff.
I have been speaking with journalist, science fiction author, and digital rights activist Cory Doctorow. His new web book, How to Destroy Surveillance Capitalism, is available on 10 Medium's Tech and Science publication. Cory, thanks for spending so much time with us today.
Oh, thank you for so much airtime. I love WNYC. I have like 9 million of your podcasts in my podcatcher.